you. My first poem is called Training. I'm thinking of living forever. I think that way I might finally get my shit straight and solve the crosswords. I'm considering outlasting everyone, although I know I'd have a hard time not having read Ulysses past the first chapter. I don't care if death smells like nutmeg. I don't buy the plot line on eternal rest. By staying alive, someday, I might manage to hail a taxi and fulfill my father's wish of hitting town without a red light. I couldn't expect to avoid anger or brooding or to make the journey with my beasts appeased. But I might walk vast expanses of earth and always be beginning. And I love beginning, or could learn to love it. Recently, where I work, I faced the possibility of losing my job, which happens to a lot of people, of course, because they laid so many people off. And a friend of mine said, well, why don't you make a list of things you'd love to do? You know, make an idealized list rather than just thinking of what people might pay you to do. Decide if there's something you really would enjoy and go for that. So what I came up with was a very short list of impossible professions. An offshoot of that exercise, in part, was this poem. It's called Medieval Photographer. In a past life, I imagine I was a medieval photographer, toiling to capture the wrist of a prince perspiring in vinegar sleeves. With anachronous baggage, I recorded the horse collar and caravan, wheels crossing a field of bodies to cast gradations of shade, dappled and matte, on the dust and death's beclouded countenance. From up close, I shot the rats and the ramshackle, a wash maid and a scalloped barrel of black wine seeping out of its frame. I blundered with an exposure slow as a brushstroke and saw death a thousand times by the sword, at the stake, through the plague, souls detaching from boils and decay, and captured them for the sake of what I could offer this incarnation and afterlife. Where clouds still recall a marled ceiling convulsing with angels and snakes. Riding backwards on the train. It's not unpleasant, perpetual surprise. But instead of feeling I'll arrive, the world appears to pour towards whatever I'm getting away from. Cows and foliage blur by, and I try to imagine easing into couch cushions, or the plunge back onto bed, quilt whooshing up from behind. Still, I can't shake the faint dyslexia reverse riding brings. The suspicion I'm rushing ass backwards into the future, kick me sign tacked to my spine. A breech berth with no eye for what's ahead, until it crashes into the past. The inkling I'm a fool, doing the backstroke, smack up against the wall of the pool. The next poem is about awkward social situations. It's for introverts as well as extroverts. Etiquette. I was doing my best at the friendly gesture, eating stiff clam dip with pita, drinking, quite frankly, stinking bad wine. When the talk died of boredom, I began building a little city in my mind, complete with harbor, a firehouse full of well-meaning white guys beamed from my eyes like a lineup of polite New England ancestors. My hostess cramped the room, passing out snacks, upsetting the wharf I was at work on. I got to unrolling a pier into the water when my cigarette snagged on a plank and set the city on fire. Stanching the flames with my sleeve, I tried to play casual, waving and smiling, but the hostess came hovering closer and clapped up a draft. And since the flames were rising, and the bile too was rising, and clams from the hot sea came rising, and though her taste in music was torture, my hostess was clapping her hands in a command to dance. Grassland. When I could not get with child, I swallowed the egg of the meadowlark who eats the daylight, the mother of untangled grasses. A long drop, the egg bore its root in my foot. It stitched me together with brain. I am patient now. I'm not damaged by waiting. Languid as a coming rain stalks inch alongside my veins to the tips of my fingers. A grassland has thirst. So does a fire, a cup, noon, the color of dough. So while I sleep, the moon creeps between my poised teeth to flood me with moon water. When I speak, the scent of lingering wheat overwhelms me. Shoots rise straight up and don't droop as tears. They don't fail like questions. They get on with growing. I hold a handkerchief over my mouth to veil the clover and beeves that tickle my throat. But the angel who's due at my tent won't catch me laughing. A kiss would do it. One sprinkle of milk white salt, and I'll break like bread at your table. The next poem is kind of the reason I'm here. It's the poem from the poetry video that won the award last year. It's called Dictionary Illustrations. Searching for a word, I set off browsing the dictionary illustrations. Pages flush with fish and obscure instruments and myriad breeds of duck, which colorless end up looking much the same. These artists don't dawdle amongst the obvious. They illuminate the Oriel window. They trace the low bait foot of the grebe. The reindeer appears tame and boxy on paper, gigantic antlers bearing the weight of reincarnation. On page 1291, drawings disambiguate the difference between paley and paley-bendy, two patterns of heraldry. Think roadblock versus barbershop, TV off-air image versus LSD. They don't do verbs in dictionary pictures. So for Ziff, here's an inch-wide depiction of two tiny men intent on fencing. In one two-page arrangement, the seahorse floats peacefully beyond the reach of the scythe. Sketches break the columns up like little windows opening from one side of the brain to the other. Tiptoe through and pay attention to the shapes of leaves, which can be hard to describe. That video after this. Mm-hmm. They have a child read it, and it's much more wonderful than what I read. I tried to engage a child outside to come in and read it. The police stopped me. sometimes I have a friend who asks me, why don't I write love poems? And I say, I do write love poems, but all my love poems are to books. So that was a cop-out, huh? So Dictionary Illustrations is, of course, a book about a poem about books. And this poem is a love poem for used books. I like them dog-eared and lawn-soft, and savor the character of line stain and thumb smudge, the tear warp between pages, scrawl, lolling down margins, X's, question, and check marks, scratched out as anchors. They kindle affinity with readers who've leaped through before, house a kinship of signatures, conjuring towns and streets and states I'll never visit. They preach the economy of timber and persons, while scribbled dates evoke evenings spent couch lounging through past springs and winters. Though they come off the press crisp and unsullied, I like them used for the gust of tinder and sawdust, the waft of feathers adrift in a hayloft. I turn the yellow hem of the pages, a hue half neon, half tubercular, like the wallpaper of a motel, nicotine thick with confessions, with the fray, I find repose under covers worn and well plumbed. I forgot to look at the time when I started, so you'll have to kick me when I've gone on too long. The next poem is called The Russians Go With Everything. It seems apt these days, since the Russians seem to turn up everywhere. I work in the news, and it seems you can't write a story in the news these days without there being Russians involved. So they go one day from being good guys to being bad guys to being good guys again. It depends on who you're reading, I suppose. Nevertheless, The Russians Go With Everything is a poem about books again, about Russian books. I tend a long shelf of them because they go with spring as well as winter, when the Kremlin cuts the power and one must read by snowlight. I wear a dark one on my arm to work. I clutch another like a purse whenever I set out to do some serious rambling. I hate it when some readers say the cold is like a character. When a character wants soul and should not lack volition. The dwarf spruce of the tundra needs so little to live, nothing in fact, and thus they may crop up all over the globe like a rash of fur caps, like a world of people who wouldn't mind dying in train stations, as long as Christmas has passed and one has good boots, as long as the station master has a knack for the tragic and one runs no real chance of getting arrested. The next poem is also a found poem, but not a visual found poem. To write it, I used another Russian book called Voices from Chernobyl. It's a book by Svetlana Alexievich. She won the Nobel Prize 2 years ago. She's a journalist. And her books all consist of interviews with people. She's written a number of books, of course, but they're all the same style. Voices of Chernobyl is all interviews with people affected by the Chernobyl disaster. And to write this poem, I used one interview with a woman whose husband was a fireman who went to the disaster site right after the explosion. And I simply collaged some of the lines and words together to write this poem. Newlyweds, Ukraine, 1986. I don't know what I should talk about death or about summertime. Who's going to explain how the mouth wants a kiss and a flame the whole sky? At first there were little lesions in the morning. They came off in layers, white film, a transparent curtain. Then burns like black handkerchiefs came to the surface. The trolley stopped running, the trains. They were washing the streets in white powder. No one told us a coffin could be built from a loaf of bread. Barefoot in his formal wear, my love squeezed into bed. There was an orange on his table, a swollen one, pink. He smiled. I got it as a gift. Take it. The nurse was gesturing through the plastic film that I couldn't eat it. It had been near him a while. Not only could you not eat it, you shouldn't even look at it. Come on, he said. You love oranges. Oh. And the next poem is actually also a found poem from the same book. And to write this one, I went through the book and collected all the questions in the book from different people and chose the ones to make into this poem. Seven shaved bald in one room. How did the station burn? Do you remember how it was in Tolstoy? The explosion, did you see? My son calls from Gomel to ask, are the Maybugs out? We'll sit sometimes and count, who's died? Who are we burying? What are we going to name him? One thing I don't know is, do people have souls? How do they all fit into the next world? My grandpa took 2 days to die. I was hiding behind the stove and waiting. How was it going to fly out of his body? Where was he going to go? Sometimes I'll close my eyes and go through the village. Well, I say to them, what radiation? Have you seen it? Is it white or what? Who's going to pay us for this beauty? How can it be dirty when it's so clean? My money is on fire. Whenever I read the newspaper, I learn my money is going to hell. It's lubricating a chute to the furnace every time I eat meat or sip whiskey, every time I wear green or live my secret life. No matter what innocence I'm up to, I'm sponsoring a disease somewhere, making souvenirs of the populace. My money is minted clean, but the moment I open my purse to buy a popsicle, it trickles out as acid rain. I sit sunning myself in the park while my money is felling sequoias, adding rage to hurricanes. I'll have to tell the drunk approaching my bench, I can't give him a red cent. Look at us. This money has done enough. Folk art. Naive, you called me. Posh and polished as a sampler sewn with yarn. Trundling, clumsy in skirts, I never got beyond the whirligig, reeling on the unmown lawn. It was my way to put things plain. I stitched a heart upon my sleeve at the elbow where the cloth was worn. You were cut from finer stuff. It's not my fault I was drawn wrong. Misfortune threw its weight around my off proportions, toppled the cock from the top of the barn. Mine was a small world, small and flawed. I could never hold you with such short arms. I just have a couple more. This one is called Ambien. I don't know if anyone knows what Ambien is. Yeah, everybody's taking it? Okay. It's that drug that puts you to sleep, but then wakes you up to make you eat while you're sleeping. So I always found that a fascinating drug. You didn't have the pleasure of eating, but you did have the pleasure of sleeping. So, Ambien. The moon bakes its marvelous loaf. The body half wakes to break it. Slumber has always smelled of vanilla, yeast, and semolina. Doped up to doze, the flesh augments. Hunger outsizes the sun into a spectacle darkness might swallow. The tongue mongers texture. Hand to mouth, nut meats crushed between teeth, or a cool sluice of cream, smooth as a stretch of dreamlessness. From drug to plunder, this swoon is a short in the circuit of urges. Feasts masquerading as sleep, lunar fuel, and the inner primitive minding the spit when the hunt's done. Duped by fullness, all night The sated brain wakes and wakes unrested to taste weariness like a wan braid of dough uncoiling, while in another room, sleep lays the table. Mm. Gazelle with broken birds. Desiring only to die on schedule, I take a floozy up to my room. His tread on the steps, a footnote in smoke. My little craft zigzags the aisles of the sea. Clarity has its price. And the flare I ignite clothes the boat in smoke. Come neither dressed nor undressed, come half cribbled, come hale. Come bride-like in white finery, come afloat in smoke. I scratch our initials in the tilt-a-whirl cab for the frenzy and thrill. When love was a letter, I wrote in smoke. No one asked, no one cared to know. Still, I put it down in my book. The dead, too, in their otherness, cast their vote in smoke. Pull the knife through the loaf, and the house explodes. Broken birds clear the roof. Their song, gone to pieces, grows remote in smoke. I've always loved wine, and when I was in my 30s, I decided it was time to legitimatize my love of wine by learning about it. I guess a lot of people get this urge. They'll become experts, and therefore it'll be okay. So I read a lot about wine, and I really enjoyed reading the wine blurbs on bottles. Not that it would teach you anything, but yeah, it always seems so pretentious and over the top and so imaginative. Unfortunately, after this short schooling I took about wine, I didn't learn much. I continued to be able to tell white from red and sweet from dry. Rosé? Rosé, yes, yeah, see, I don't know where to put that one yet, but I wrote a series of prose poems masquerading as wine blurbs called Wine Cellar, and to end, I'm just going to read a couple of those. Au vin Beaujolais. Around young wine that can't concentrate. Elastic body with an acrobatic, almost chewable bosom. The finish evokes mink, kerosene, and low satire. Toothsome and juked up with pepper. This Beaujolais is two-thirds wood smoke, one-third brioche. Can easily be paired with Chopin or Satie, but does not mix well with Dutch conductors. Robert Médoc. This is a witty, sometimes hilarious wine with an afternote of two cherry trees planted too close together. Very Mademoiselle magazine. It holds the strong nuance of cigars with side notes of suntan oil and figs. It is like the neighbor down the street with the gravelly voice and smoky good looks. You don't see him every day, but when you do, then ooh, baby. Sommelier Bordeaux. Big bells are ringing in this. here is a full-blooded wine, promiscuous and rich in after rush, guaranteed to improve your French pronunciation. Its come hither bouquet evokes chestnuts and late September. Its nose is true brunette, authentic and nutsy. The cinnamon finish is long, like all the next day long. Beaumont Syrah. This Syrah enters the mouth like an intruder and bursts into song. Aged in caves, it's developed a muscular bloom. The chief note is of toast, slathered with jam. The high proof makes this a popular choice for slumming, even if it's just around the backyard. Pairs well with game and all shades of red lipstick. Cidane Bleu. And what is champagne? Woodwinds played outdoors. The feather quilt on the clothesline. Champagne is the rain-trickled taxi that ferries the bride across town. Not the body, but the mind. Not the crown, but the tiara. Not the prayer, but the hallelujah.